Welcome to the Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Taha Lokhandwala, Deputy Personal Finance Editor at the IC. And joining me today are Peter Elston, Chief Investment Officer at Seneca Investment Management. Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Hi. Good, thanks, Taha. Good to be here.
And David Baxter, Deputy Editor of Money Management and Asset Allocator to fellow FT Specialist Titles. Hi, Dave. How are you doing?
Hi. Not bad, thanks.
Welcome to the IC Podcast for the first time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's been an interesting week, I think. Not interesting in the sense if you've got equity holdings, because all the markets have been down over the past 7 days. But I suppose Brexit has been the biggest thing as driving the news agenda, as it was the week before, and the week before that, and the week before that. But it's interesting, because we're coming to a pass here which really matters for investors, I feel, anyway, next week when we have the vote. We'll talk about the probability of what happens with the vote, but just on my basic political understanding, it sounds like it's not going to pass. But what I do think is interesting from that is what that means for stocks, because I was reading that some Goldman stats that they say if the deal fails, well, if the deal passes, let's just assume it might for a second, there'll be a 5% rise in sterling, which is quite a big rise for one day. But obviously, this is the main thing that's been depressing it, and that'd be quite good for domestic stocks, less so for FTSE 100, but probably still good generally anyway. Peter, what do you think about this? It sounds like as if at this point sterling is going to be dictating the most of the returns that investors are going to be experiencing.
I suppose first off, people who love probability trees must be having a field day at the moment. I mean, it's such an interesting situation, this, in terms of all of the various permutations, whether you're looking at a vote against the deal on the 11th of December, whether you're looking at a major defeat, whether you're looking at a not so major of defeat, all of those probabilities are continually changing. Then you look at what the implications are of each of those different scenarios, and you then have a number of other different permutations, and it just makes it incredibly difficult as an investor to try to position portfolios according to, you know, the various permutations out there. I mean, if I might just go back to 2016, which I think is quite instructive in terms of what might be a better way of thinking about Brexit. Back then, our portfolio positioning, we hadn't really changed any positioning in relation to Brexit. We had quite a large chunk of our portfolios in UK mid-caps. We didn't hold any gilts or other developed market government bonds, thinking that they were horribly expensive, which they were. And we also didn't have much foreign exchange exposure, again, thinking that over time just gives you a lot of risk, but not much in the way of return. Now, in the days following that referendum vote, all of those three positions went against us. Yeah. Mid-caps fell sharply. Sterling fell. So, in relation to our peers who had quite a lot of FX exposure, our funds didn't do so well. And, of course, government bonds rose sharply. So our funds plummeted down the peer group rankings on a very short-term basis. However, since then, or following that initial period, they've done very well because, of course, you know, once the dust settles, you realize that actually these mid-cap companies are pretty good, and people realize that government bonds are very expensive, and also sterling starts to settle down or indeed rise again as it did. So the point is that actually, if you stick to the fundamentals of buying good companies, believing that government bonds are expensive, which they are, believing that foreign exchange exposure is actually a bad idea, then you'll be okay. But trying to sort of protect yourself against every eventuality is just extremely hard. You just can't do it. And I think being a good fund manager, being a good investor, is all about accepting risks. What's the alternative? The alternative is to stay at home all day, not get out of bed, because you're just so worried about all of the different risks. You can't do that. Accept that there's going to be volatility, but stick to fundamentals, and you should be okay.
No, so good advice going into next week, definitely. Especially, we just generally don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how no. markets are going to react at all, do we? Like,
absolutely.
It's madness. I mean, just one theory as well. Again, I fully appreciate your point, but there'll be a short rally if the deal fails, just because of the low probability of no deal, based on the amendments that we've seen in Parliament this week. So there's so many moving parts. But yeah, I suppose... Yeah, do one or two things. Listen to Peter or shut the curtains, I suppose. what else we've seen this week? It's interesting, we've got some statistics from the Investment Association this week as well. We mentioned these a couple of months ago in this podcast. The statistics tell us what funds have been bought and sold, in this case, over the course of October. And it's interesting because it kind of demonstrates, I suppose, what other investors are doing, professional and private investors alike. October was, as you may remember, as I'm sure your ISAs certainly do, not... the best of months. But it's interesting that the stats have come out and showed us. It's not been as clear a picture as it seems, does it, Dave?
No, so it's been a mix. Yeah, obviously, as it's now known, Red October, if we're going to stick with that that term.
I'd rather not. Okay. You've said it now, so...
Set the precedent. It was a very difficult time for markets. All asset classes were down. A lot of that was to do with the fact that rates are slowly starting to rise. So, as you'd expect, bond funds sold off very heavily, $1.6 billion net outflows, and equity sales were positive but very modest. But what's interesting is if you break down some of the best-selling groups. So, on the one hand, you've had some people buying money market funds, going into cash.
And sure, I suppose it makes sense if you're selling out of bond funds and you're looking for protection, I imagine.
Yeah, but yeah. And if, as we've discussed, people are just closing the curtains, they just want no risk, then that makes sense. But I suppose that's the kind of ultimate safety play. But then you've seen some more nuanced decisions. So some people, for example, have been buying global equity funds, which suggests they may be buying the dip, thinking this is just a short-term overreaction by the markets. I still think, you know, things may go up in future, so I'm going to get a bit more exposure. Similarly, people have been taking more mixed kind of multi-asset plays, but these still involve potentially fairly high exposure to equities. So they're taking a step back, but they're still looking to participate in potential equity market rises. Which I suppose for the last couple of years has been the big debate. You know, do I think markets are going to crash, and do I step out or really dial back my exposure? Or do I think, no, this is too much opportunity cost, I need to be in there still?
So this is interesting because two things. What we can't see from the stats is whether all the selling happened in the first 2 weeks and then, as you said, everyone went, okay, this is now overdone. And then all the sales we've seen have been in the second 2 weeks from different people with dry powder on the sidelines and stuff like that. But I suppose the other thing is whether people realised mid-October whether this was a fundamental correction or a valuation-driven correction. Was this because people worried about recession, or was this people worried about tech stocks? What was your take on October?
Well, that's absolutely right. The big question is, what did October represent? Did it represent the start of something prolonged and pronounced, i.e. the next bear market? Because bear markets are like death and taxes. They're guaranteed to happen. Or was it simply a correction that followed a few months of quite unusual behavior? The rise in markets had been focused purely on the US since April. And then within the US, it was really just a very small number of tech stocks that had been driving the rally. And that was totally unsustainable. And it may well have been that markets woke up in October and realized just how unsustainable that sort of behavior was. And there was a correction. I think, for what it's worth, that... October represented a correction on the simple basis that you look across the world and monetary policy is still extremely loose. Even in the US, where you've seen interest rate rises for the last, since I think it was December 2014, be wrong by a year or so. 15, okay. Monetary policy is still very loose in the US, or at least it's moved from being accommodative to neutral. Elsewhere in the world, it's still extremely loose. And that provides quite a supportive backdrop to equities. And whilst I think we probably are entering the stage of the cycle where, you know, returns from equities are falling, I don't think we've quite yet got the factors in place, the backdrop in place for the start of a bear market. So what lies ahead? Probably quite a lot more volatility, but we should still see over, you know, the course of the next year or two, reasonably positive returns.
Okay, no, I was just going to be my next point. So the reason why I think, and so me and David were chatting about this earlier as well, that the IA statistics for October are important is because it tells us what happened in that month, and I suppose it helps us decipher what might happen in future. So what are we looking at next year then? Is it going to be something of the case of where we have these kind of, okay, I suppose UK equities aside, because you've got the political influence there that we can't decide. Are we going to have these kind of steady rises and then massive falls and steady rises and massive falls and steady rises and massive falls? Is that just what we have to accept coming into 2019?
I think it probably is. You know, this is a reflection of what you tend to get in the sort of the late stages of a cycle. When monetary policy is being tightened, when valuations are starting to get a little bit stretched, you are naturally going to see these periods like October when there are, you know, you do get some quite nasty falls. So I think it probably is what we've got to look forward to.
Okay.
And Peter, you mentioned the narrowing of those stocks and regions, obviously, that have driven performance. So since summer, you've seen global equities really decouple from the US, and the US has been doing well until around October, whereas the rest really hasn't. And then those falls have been more focused on FANGs in the US. Is that something you would expect to sort of maintain or even increase?
Well, you know, you take the FANGs out of the US market, and actually the rest of the US hasn't been doing that well either this year. So, you know, this question of whether the performance of the FANGs can continue is a difficult one. I mean, it's very, very hard to value these stocks because, you know, a lot of the growth in the FANGs is ahead of us rather than in the present. So it's very hard to value that.
Just going to jump in and let everyone know that FANGs are the textbooks, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix and Google.
Indeed. Yeah. So, look, I think there's all sorts of headwinds that those stocks face. Mm. You know, increasingly people are talking about trying to regulate them more. Increasingly, you know, people are sort of aware of some of the sort of the negative things associated with those companies. So I think they probably are entering a more difficult period. But it's quite hard to say. What we try to do at Seneca is to understand where monetary policy is going to go, and to guide us there, what we're looking at are inflation pressures, and to guide us there, what we're looking at is unemployment. And unemployment now across the world is extremely low. Mm. It's at a four-decade low. In the US and the UK, unemployment is at a 50-year low. And what does this mean? Well, it means that labor markets are extremely tight. It means that wage pressures are growing, and wage pressures will feed through to inflation. And central banks don't like inflation that's too high. And when that starts to happen, they want to take the punch bowl away. And taking the punch bowl away, you're removing support for so-called risky assets like equities, et cetera. That's what we try to focus on. It's never going to tell you what markets are going to do over periods of 1-2 months, but what we think is it'll give us a good guide to how things might pan out over the next 1-2 years. And if you can do that, you can add value through an asset allocation framework.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Speaking of asset allocation, it was quite interesting. So last week we had Chris Dillow, the IC economist, on the show. He was talking about the yield curve, and when it inverts, that tends to be a longer-term sign of recession, and therefore that should be a good sign of when to start reducing your equity allocation. And he was talking in the context of the fact that the US yield curve was still positive, so therefore, you know, equity markets were deemed to go higher. This week they started to invert, in a sort of very bizarre set of circumstances. What does that tell us? Do you have any thoughts on this?
So obviously it's viewed as a very reliable indicator of future recessions. Depending on how you measure it, it's been a good indicator, I think, for every recession since World War II, I was reading.
Mm. Eight of them, I think.
Oh, eight.
Eight recessions, yes, and they've all been preceded by a yield curve inversion. And not only that, but it's never given a false reading, so it has been a pretty reliable indicator.
So there are lots of those kind of potentially flashing lights you can look at in times like this, and this is perhaps one to pay more attention to. And just to explain a bit more, it's when the lower end is yielding more than the...
So the shorter dated bonds.
Exactly, yeah. Because normally you would expect to want a government to pay you more to borrow for longer because there's more risk, so that's quite unusual. And a lot of people regard it as a sign that central banks are tightening monetary policy too quickly. Mm. Although I did see, obviously, a lot of insights come from Twitter nowadays.
It's where I get all my information
from. Yeah, everything. I was just reading something today where someone was making the point that maybe the curve inversion is being more widely discussed this time than previous times. So does that...
So make it a false positive, I suppose.
Yeah, does that mean
it introduces a self-fulfilling element, doesn't it? You know, if people are thinking it means something, then it will, because you'll get a recession being caused by people becoming a teenager.
Yeah. Purely based on the yield curve.
I'm sure we're helping that by talking about it on this show. I suppose that's a good time as I need to move on, so don't listen to us on the yield curve, because we don't know. Okay, let's turn to some funds news this week. Magazine, we talk about a consultation from the Investment Association about including ETFs in their sectors. So sectors, as listeners may be aware, are groupings of funds that are similar, so you can compare one fund to another and make sure you're finding the best strategy in it, or the best fund in a specific strategy, like UK equity income or European equities, etc. The IA at the moment only includes open-ended funds. They can be active and passive, but they tend to be open-ended. Well, they are open-ended. And they're thinking about including ETFs, which is quite unusual, because they are two different types of fund structures. They tend not to be... What's the argument here? For me, it seems unusual, but if funds are doing the same thing, then why shouldn't they be compared at the same time? And what's your thoughts on this consultation?
Yeah, I mean... Really, an ETF versus an open-ended fund is just a structure, but you can still potentially do the same things. So if you have a open-ended tracker fund, you could track, say, the FTSE 100. And with a ETF, you could do exactly the same thing. Main difference is ETF is more easily tradable, and you can exploit, you know, differences in pricing.
There's a wonderful feature in IC from a few months ago explaining the difference between open-ended passive funds and ETFs, just as a...
Yeah, on the one hand, this could be a really good thing, because it just allows more transparency, which is always good for the industry. It allows investors to compare and contrast, so you can see not just different passives versus each other, focusing on the same area, but you can see them versus active. So you could look at, say, US equity funds and see that, I imagine you'd see that only a few funds manage to beat those ETFs and passive funds, and that could inform your decisions, either of what active funds you pick or whether you go passive. So that's a good thing, although it's worth mentioning one criticism, and that is that basically by including ETFs, you're just going to get a load of very similar funds. They're going to cluster around the same point in terms of performance, and it's just going to confuse investors too much.
That's what I mean, because there's already, I mean, the IA sectors, there's 37 sectors, and they have close to 4,000 funds. And they're talking about, is it about 200 ETFs?
200, yeah.
So I suppose in the grand scheme of things, it's not a significant amount, but a lot of these ETFs all do the same thing. You know, there are more than a handful of FTSE 100 ETFs, or FTSE All Share, FTSE 250, S&P 500, Stoxx 50 for European equities. So just the, I'm thinking about the UK all company sector, which I suppose is the one that's used the most to find the best active UK equity funds. You've just got this influx of passive UK trackers, and they're all going to be sitting, if I say, around the same thing, and then it's just making it harder to find the best active fund, is it not?
Possibly. I mean, that is a valid argument. But like you say, I mean, it's only 200-ish funds. If you average that out over 37 sectors, what are you getting, like an average of 6 or 7 per sector? So is that really going to...
Quick math then, last year.
Pre-done math. the best kind. I guess one point that's interesting to make is performance isn't always as similar as you might expect. So first of all, on the pure passive front, if you look at global trackers or EM trackers, different providers like FTSE and MSCI will include different countries and give different countries different weightings. So over a decent time period, you can see a reasonable divergence in performance. So maybe it is worth kind of highlighting those differences. Another thing that's interesting to look at, I imagine being it's only 200 ETFs, this would be some of your more conventional passive strategies.
So, yeah, your big indices like we just talked about.
Exactly, yeah. Like your bog standard kind of equity tracker. But it could open the door to maybe at some point in future including so-called smart beta, where you focus on a factor. So you might have an ETF, for example, that buys stocks in the FTSE 100 that yield, say, 3.5% or more.
So, yeah, so smart beta, I suppose, is technically it's a passive fund, but that doesn't weight according to traditional market caps. It doesn't just buy more of the biggest stocks. It actually decides its weighting based on a different criteria.
Normally... or quite often it will use its own kind of self-crafted index, and that will differ from the conventional index.
Okay. So one of the biggest sector, well, the biggest sector in the IA sectors is UK equity income. And there are plenty of these smart beta ETFs, as you mentioned, that focus on kind of high-yielding stocks, and they have different ways of calculating to make sure that investors get the most income. So how does that... how does this, let's say you've got all these kind of smart beta equity income ETFs coming into the IA UK equity income sector.
Yeah.
What are the pros and cons of that? I suppose it's a good thing because you can see which active funds are doing best, but is there any issues with that one?
I mean, it's great on the one hand because sometimes arguments have been made that active managers rely more on style or kind of broader decisions rather than stock picking. And with smart beta, you might be able to see this a bit more clearly. So if there's a style and it's outperforming or performing very similarly to a lot of active managers, then you can see that those active managers may be more reliant on
market style, market factors
rather than kind of, you know, magical stock picking finesse.
It's almost as if you're a bit sceptical.
No, not at all.
But I suppose you might think that as an active manager, I'd be an opponent of passive funds and ETFs and a move like this, but actually that's not the case. I think that passive funds, ETFs, make a huge amount of sense for people who maybe don't have the wherewithal or the time or the inclination to look at active funds and try to, you know, identify some of the better active funds. It does make sense for them to go into passive funds. So I'm actually very supportive of this. I think the more that more transparency that there is, the more people are able to compare funds, whether it's within passive funds. I mean, Dave, you mentioned that different passive funds, say the US, can track different indices. Yeah. There are also more nuanced differences as well in relation to how these passive funds or ETFs are trying to get exposure, whether they are using synthetic exposure or getting actual exposure to underlying stocks. Those can cause differences in performance. Costs can cause a difference. But the more, I think, the more ability there is for people to compare and contrast, the better.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. One thing I think that's synthetic is quite a good point. So one thing the IA aren't doing is going to put any synthetic ETFs in this as well. So again, that I actually see that as a downside, because synthetic ETFs are complex, but they do have their place in the industry, and they're not including them in the IA sectors is basically favouring one over the other. I feel, and it's a personal thought.
Although, are they just trying to protect investors there? So if you're doing something slightly more esoteric, and that's really influencing your returns one way or another,
I suppose. But yeah, but like the synthetic FTSE 100s, like Lixor have a couple of very low charging synthetic FTSE 100s. But again, I suppose in the IC top 50, we don't include synthetic ETFs, so we've already made that decision as well. So
yeah.
I stand down my point, having just remembered that criteria for the IC top 50. Oh yeah, other news this week came from Kames, who I think they have some bond managers left. So yeah, Kames are Kames Capital, part of Aegon, have some decent funds. They were well known for their fixed income funds, actually. They were quite popular. But then last year, their two most senior fixed income fund managers left to join Lion Trust, leaving behind a quite a strong team. But then something else has happened, hasn't it, Dave?
Yeah, it's a bit a moment of deja vu, I guess. So they're just recovering from back, like you say, in summer 2017, replaced their old co-heads of fixed income.
So this is David Roberts and Phil Milburn?
Yes, they were the guys who left for Lion Trust that you mentioned. And now Stephen Snowden, another quite well-known, well-respected Kames bond manager, and three of his colleagues have departed to go to Artemis, which...
I suppose it's, can the last bond manager at Kames turn the lights off?
yeah.
The funds affected are the Kames Investment Grade Bond Fund and the Kames High Yield Bond Fund, along with some of their Absolute Return bond funds, but they're not available on the DTC platforms. Fund manager departures is a part and parcel of fund buying, I suppose, but the situation seems slightly different, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean... Who was it? Was it Morningstar in their ratings were basically talking about, they used the term highly volatile when they talked about the stability of the, or high instability, I think, of the team.
More something akin to an asset class rather than team, isn't it?
Basically sterling in a couple of months. So, I mean, you can argue that maybe the processes will stay the same and they are replacing them. But when people are moving around that much, it will really give you pause for thought. And you will think, you know, do I want to kind of step back, see what's going to happen with these funds, see whether the new team sort of comes together quite well, how they work together. So it is worth taking a look at that. Although what's interesting, we were looking at this for Asset Allocator with regard to DFMs and what DFMs use.
So discretionary
fund managers. So basically professional investors. What they were doing with regard to these funds. And some of the affected funds, no one holds them because last year
they already
the
sold
team
that.
Left. Yeah. It's not a great week,
not
is
great.
It?
No, it's not. It's worth noting as well that anyone that did hold these funds on rating has suspended them based on these departures, which again is supposed relatively common, but not always that common. Sometimes they say they're under review while we meet the team, but in this case it just seems we're now taking
straight
these ratings
it.
Away
yeah.
because you've lost your entire team. Anyway, if you do hold those funds, obviously never suggesting you sell, but certainly a look out for if anything changes on those in that area. Okay, so that's that was the funds news. So you can read more on the IA ETF consultation and Kames in the magazine this week. You can also read more on the Smart Beta funds as well. Turning to asset allocation, which is probably going to be the most... It's the kind of time of year where everyone's thinking about how their portfolio is structured and what they should be doing. It seems to be a Gregorian-driven phenomenon. Something you do at the end of the year. Peter, we've sat down and discussed asset allocation many times in the past. What are your thoughts now? So for context, should we have a kind of brief explanation on I suppose you alluded to your monetary policy driven asset allocation model that you operate.
Mm-hmm.
So where's that taken us from, let's say, June 2017 to now? What have you been doing in your multi-asset portfolio?
Sure. Yeah. Well, if I may just set out a little bit about our framework that we use. So, you know, the reality is that markets go up and down in fairly recognizable patterns. Obviously, the terms, you know, equity bull market and equity bear market are very well understood. You get the same sorts of patterns in bonds, other assets, commodities, etc. And I think the key question with asset allocation is, are those cycles predictable? If they're not predictable, then there's no point in trying to predict them and have some sort of active asset allocation framework. You might as well just have a passive approach and just stick with a certain percentage in various different asset classes, equities, bonds, etc. However, in my view, in our view, and in the view of many other sort of respected academics, a lot of these cycles are predictable. You can actually predict, not with 100% accuracy, but the key is you don't need 100% accuracy, you just need some accuracy. You can actually predict equity market ups and downs. You can predict the cycles in bond markets. And the way you do that is essentially by focusing on monetary policy. Monetary policy is everything, essentially, because that will tell you some very key things. It'll tell you whether central banks want to support economies and thus markets, whether they're trying to restrain economies and markets. The price of money, which is essentially what we're talking about here with monetary policy, will affect the demand for equities. Because let's face it, all financial assets compete for investor attention with cash. So if you're getting a better return on cash because monetary policy is being tightened, that will reduce the demand for risky assets, whether that's equities or bonds with a longer duration. So how do you make these predictions? Well, how do you look at monetary policy? The key is, as I alluded to earlier, is to look at employment. Employment is, you know, the key feature of any economy. That's what economies are trying to do, essentially, is to put as many people to work as possible. But there are times when they fail to do that, and that's in recessions. These cycles of unemployment, they don't follow quite a neat sort of sine wave, as the theory books might suggest, but you can absolutely discern patterns. You look at unemployment in the UK or the US, and there's definitely a pattern there. And that will dictate monetary policy, and monetary policy will help you to understand what financial assets are going to do. And if you can do that, you can obviously build what would be called a tactical asset allocation framework to add value over time. Very hard to add value in the short term. You have to accept that these movements are predictable, not over 1 or 2 months, but over periods of 1, 2, 3 years. And that's also key.
Having followed your fund, I suppose this takes us, so you saw monetary policy tightening, and therefore the logical step was to start thinking about reducing your equity allocation, because obviously, as you said, equities will be competing with a higher cash rate and therefore doing as well. So you reduce equity exposure. So you're now down to about 37%. Equities, is that about right, in the growth fund?
Well, it depends on which of our
funds
you're looking at. Roughly speaking, we're depending on whether there's an income mandate for the funds have to generate income. They've got less flexibility with asset allocation, but we're somewhere between 8 and 10 percentage points underweight equities for our funds. We started reducing equities from a heavy overweight position quite a long time ago now, a year and a half or so ago, maybe a bit longer. And then at the end of last year, we moved underweight. And since then, we've continued to move underweight, and we will continue to move even further underweight over the next few months in the hope that we will be the most underweight when the bear market starts. Now, chances of us actually doing that are zero. Ideally,
this is a good acceptance to have, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, again, it's about accepting certain things. Ideally, we would know exactly when the bear market's going to start, and we would move over a matter of days from being very overweight to very underweight. And of course, that's just a total absurdity. You're never going to get it right. I mentioned earlier that my belief is that October was just a correction. I could be wrong. October could well have been the start of the next bear market. Now, the way in which you build that uncertainty into portfolios is to start reducing early. And the analogy that I use, you probably heard me use it before, is you're driving a car, you're approaching a bend. When do you brake? Do you brake when you get to the bend? No. You brake well ahead of it. That is the conservative, the right thing to do. And it's a very useful analogy with asset allocation. You've got to start preparing early on the basis that you could be wrong.
No, absolutely. That makes sense. So you reduced equities. What did you go into? I assume you're not sitting on 40% cash.
No, not yet. Not yet. And we would never get to that level.
That's being flippant, yeah.
Of course. I suppose two things there. Firstly, which equities have we been reducing? And the second question is where have we been putting those proceeds? If I might just consider the first question
first. No, of course. Yeah, please.
So where do you reduce equities first? Well, you reduce equities first where the business cycle is most advanced, because that's where monetary policy is getting tightened first. And so that meant that we reduced US equities first. And in fact, we, across all of our funds, we've moved to zero in the US early this year, which, was a very high conviction position. We all know how big a portion the US is of global indices. And that position is now starting to work for us. We secondly started to reduce the UK, because that's where you've also got monetary policy that's being tightened. Elsewhere, Japan, Europe, monetary policy is still very loose. They haven't even increased interest rates there yet. Asia and EM, slightly different, because there those areas are not so much about cycles. They're more about structural long-term growth. Mm. So we don't tend to think about business cycles for those areas quite as much. And also, the markets are more inefficient. So there's greater opportunity in those markets to add value through stock picking, through picking the right funds. So where have we been putting the proceeds? Well, three areas. Firstly, into cash. Secondly, into some of our fixed income funds. But because we think government bonds are horribly expensive, you don't want duration risk. Duration risk is something you absolutely want to avoid at the moment. So what does that mean? Well, if you don't want duration risk, what can you rely on? Well, you can rely on credit risk. But you have to, in other words, buying corporate bonds, particularly high yield bonds, which are offering decent yields. But you have to make sure you're investing either in the funds where the manager has a very good credit analysis framework. In other words, they're going to avoid the bonds at default, or indeed you yourself have got to have a good credit.
Any favoured funds in this space?
Hopefully, well, I won't mention funds, but what I will also say is the final area where we've been putting money into, which is what we call specialist assets, and these are essentially investment trusts that invest in real estate, in other words, real estate investment trusts, private equity, infrastructure. And then the final area is what we call specialist financial, which is a particularly interesting area. So that includes things like aircraft leasing, trusts that buy aircraft and then lease them to airlines. These are generating yields in the order of 8%, plus scope for some capital growth. Been a recent issue of a fund, a launch of a fund that invests in music royalties.
Oh, yes. What's the name of that fund?
Hypnosis.
Yes, yeah.
Songs. And that's a really interesting opportunity there because, you know, we've seen the end of piracy, music piracy, because of the rise of these streaming services. And that has presented a huge opportunity for the value of songs to increase. But the point is that what you're looking for in this area is things that you can't get from equities or bonds. And what that means is you can get decent yields that bonds don't offer. You can get some inflation protection. The income streams from these trusts have some inflation linkage. And you've also got more stability in relation to equity. Obviously, earnings in equities goes up and down. You've got much more stability here. So really interesting area to invest in.
Okay.
You mentioned yields. We recently have been taking a bit of a look at where income comes from in portfolios. And a lot of it still seems to come from equity income. So what's your sort of balance there? You mentioned these 8% yields and...
Yeah. Well, the UK is an interesting one because, you know, although we're looking at the stage of the cycle when equities should be at some point starting to perform poorly, the starting point is a little unusual. Yields are quite good in the UK. I mean, the yields on our UK equity portfolios, which are predominantly mid-caps, are well over 5%, approaching 6%. That represents fantastic value. So it's a little bit of a tricky one, and all of that is because of the negative sentiment associated with Brexit. But that's okay. You can balance the two competing forces of negative sentiment associated with Brexit against where we are in the cycle.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that, Peter. That was absolutely fascinating. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week, but you can read more on asset allocation, the fund's news, this feature on Smart Beta in this week's magazine, or on the website. But apart from that, have a good weekend.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.